Welcome to the Depth Dive. Today, we are taking on a massive organizational and theological challenge, one that really affects millions of people all over the world.
It really does.
Our Deep Dive mission is to examine this dramatic, almost high-stakes shift in how the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints manages internal member doubt.
And this isn't just about theology, right? This is a case study.
Yeah.
It's about how a huge faith institution has to pivot its entire survival strategy when it's faced with, you know, the internet, the democracy of the digital age.
Exactly. It truly is a fascinating, almost existential study in organizational control.
It is. We're tracing a timeline that spans, what, nearly a century?
Mm-hmm.
Moving from a world where the church, I mean, literally and physically controlled what members could read.
Right up to now.
Right up to the current, you know, chaotic digital era. And that transition, it marks a total collapse of the old way of doing things and the frantic emergence of a new one.
And the tension at the center of all of this is so acute. How does a faith that relies so heavily on a foundational, often simplified, faith-based narrative, how does it reconcile those stories with the internet?
With the ease of access to the most inconvenient primary source historical evidence.
For the first 150 years, the strategy was blunt. It was suppression, demonization, punishment. But that just doesn't work anymore.
No.
The new strategy is subtle, it's sophisticated, and it's aimed directly at the youth. They call it inoculation.
And, you know, to really appreciate the depth of this current crisis,
yeah,
we have to acknowledge that doubt, it's not new to the LDS Church. This institution has faced massive challenges and, you know, waves of defection since its earliest days.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, think about the economic failures like the Kirtland Safety Society Bank back in the 1830s.
Yeah.
That led to some really high-profile excommunications.
Or polygamy.
Or the intense crises surrounding polygamy in the 19th century. Or even the failed prophecies about retaking land in Missouri. Members have always had reasons to question things.
So if these historical challenges have always been there, what makes this current era, let's call it the digital crisis of the 21st century, what makes it so fundamentally different?
The difference is the absolute loss of information asymmetry. That's the key. In the past, the church could use geography, print control, social pressure. They could physically constrain what members were reading. Today, that is completely gone.
Right.
As the former church historian Marlon Jensen noted, the church has virtually no control over the information members access.
Whether you're looking at social media groups or those in-depth websites like Mormon Think, the CES Letter,
or long-form analysis on platforms like Mormon Stories, the information is accessible, it's verifiable, and it's available instantly on your phone.
And Jensen didn't really mince words about the scale of this problem, did he?
No, not at all. He declared that this current period of apostasy might be the most significant crisis since Kirtland itself.
Wow, since Kirtland.
Yeah, where the foundational prophetic authority of Joseph Smith was first really heavily challenged by his own followers.
That perspective, it just underscores the gravity of the situation.
It does. When historical documents, and a lot of these have been squirreled away in institutional archives for decades, and some are even coming from the church's own records now, when they're just readily available online.
You can't just claim the discrepancies are anti-Mormon lies anymore.
Exactly. Members can now do comparative analysis. They can contrast the different accounts of the first vision. They can track how foundational revelations evolved or cross-reference claims about the priesthood restoration.
So the institution is forced. They either have to validate all that historical complexity or just radically change their strategy for dealing with dissent.
Which is what we're seeing.
That sets the stage perfectly. So our mission here is to understand the methods, the institutional strategies themselves, while keeping an objective, analytical tone. We're examining the playbook as it shifted from, say, the hammer to the scalpel.
Perfect way to put it.
So let's start by unpacking that old playbook. Before the internet, when the church had geographic, cultural, and just this ironclad informational control, how did they handle serious challenges when they arose?
Well, the core strategy was it was built on isolation and punishment.
Simple and effective.
And highly effective for decades, yeah. You excommunicate the public doubters, you define them as dangerous outsiders, and you successfully constrict knowledge about them.
You stop the contagion.
You prevent what they viewed as intellectual contagion. They leveraged all their institutional power to successfully define critics as evil or apostate or simply anti-Mormon. They built this highly effective firewall of cultural ignorance around the general membership.
And this strategy is just perfectly illustrated by some of the cases we have from the mid-20th century. I mean, we have to start with Farm Brody.
We have to. Brody published No Man Knows My History, which was a critical and a highly detailed biography of Justice Smith back in the mid-1940s.
And the significance here can't be overstated. She wasn't an outsider.
Not at all. She was the niece of David O. McKay, who was an apostle at the time and was about to become the president of the church.
So that proximity to the highest authority just made her dissent absolutely explosive.
Right. Her book fundamentally challenged that hagiographical narrative of Smith. It presented him as a product of his 19th century environment, not just some purely divine vessel.
And the church's response was predictable.
Immediate and definitive. Swift excommunication in a very short amount of time. And they didn't just cut her off. They successfully demonized her and her work.
Yeah.
No Man Knows My History became this unspeakable text.
The forbidden book.
For generations, yeah. Members were just conditioned to believe that even looking at the book would somehow contaminate them.
And this act of suppression, it immediately prompted the creation of organized, institutionally backed apologetics, which is so essential to the strategy.
Precisely. Hugh Nibley, who's maybe the most famous early Mormon scholar, he wrote the official definitive counter-response, "No, ma'am, that's not history."
So you have this 1-2 punch.
The combined force of institutional condemnation, the excommunication, and then a rapid authoritative intellectual rebuttal with Nibley's book. It effectively contained that first major modern wave of historically informed doubt. The walls of information control held firm.
Okay, so now let's fast forward a couple of decades. Early 1960s, we see another example of this containment strategy with Sandra and Gerald Kanner.
The Tanners. They established Utah Lighthouse Ministries, or UTLM.
And they were just tireless researchers.
Tireless. They worked for half a century, compiling extensive, often primary source-based, scholarship on issues with church truth claims, everything from the Book of Mormon translation to historical discrepancies, and they made it available in these easily digestible pamphlets and books.
But the church was still highly successful at, what, corralling them?
Yeah, corralling them is the perfect word. They put them into this designated anti-Mormon sort of cage in the public mind.
And the lack of internet access was the critical operational barrier that allowed that cage to actually work.
Absolutely. I mean, think about the logistics. The church controlled the bookstores, the schools, the whole cultural conversation in Utah and across the Intermountain West.
So if you're a member and you want to access what the Tanners have,
you have to actively and overtly seek out UTLM in Salt Lake City. You have to overcome social shaming, potential ecclesiastical discipline, geographic hurdles.
It was a huge barrier to entry.
A huge one. And that lack of accessibility, combined with this really successful decades-long demonization campaign, meant that the Tanners' reach was successfully constricted. It was confined, keeping their threat level manageable for the institution.
And this pattern, you know, academic dissent followed by an institutional crackdown, it just repeats again with tremendous severity in the 80s and 90s. Mm. And this time, it's targeting internal intellectual dissent.
Right. This is when you see academic and liberal Mormon journals like Dialogue and Sunstone gaining serious traction, and the Sunstone Symposia were getting really popular.
And crucially, these weren't outside critics.
No, these were faithful, active members. They were historians, theologians, feminist thinkers, and they just wanted to discuss the challenging historical aspects of the faith openly. The symposia were attracting thousands of attendees and subscribers.
So this represented a critical mass of self-sustaining academic dissent, operating within the cultural boundaries of the faith, but outside the official channels.
Which had to be perceived as a much greater threat than the Tanners or Brody, who were already, you know, defined as outsiders.
It was a direct institutional challenge.
It was. The church could tolerate some questioning in private, but when academic thinkers started organizing thousands of people to discuss polygamy, historical contradictions, the role of women, the church just deployed the old playbook.
And the reaction was severe.
Very severe. The church issued a policy denouncing symposia attendance, and it all culminated in what is infamously known as the September 6 in 1993.
This incident, yeah, it's often referred to internally as a bloodbath of excommunications. For our listeners who might not be familiar, what made the September 6 disciplinary action so impactful?
Well, they weren't targeting fringe members. They were targeting key intellectual figures, historians like D. Michael Quinn, feminist theologians like Janice Allred and Lynn Whitesides, prominent academics.
So their excommunication was a message.
It was a clear message that intellectual freedom and historical complexity would not be tolerated if they were publicly discussed. And this campaign continued with others, like Margaret Toscano and Brett Metcalf. It was a clear reassertion of control.
The message was, public dissent, especially intellectual dissent based on primary source research, would result in absolute expulsion.
And to summarize that 20th century strategy, you have this clear, sustained, organized effort. It's combining disciplinary action with intellectual warfare. The church invested heavily in creating this internal intellectual bulwark to just beat down doubts.
That's where organizations like Farms came from, right?
Yeah, it's exactly. The foundation for ancient research in Mormon studies, which later got absorbed into the Maxwell Institute at BYU. They weren't just a research center. They were the intellectual muscle, sponsored and funded by the institution, specifically created to counter critical information and defend the literal historicity of the Book of Mormon and other foundational claims.
So for decades, these tactics controlling physical access to information, defining critics as outsiders, punishing visible dissenters, they were extraordinarily successful at keeping that doubt genie firmly locked in the bottle.
It was a successful strategy built on isolation and punishment, where the institutional narrative was really the only viable narrative available to the membership.
But once those walls came down in the 21st century, the situation just completely reversed.
That's the perfect transition. The narrative just fundamentally changes around, say, 2004, 2005.
The rise of the Mormon internet.
That's the beginning of the end of institutional information control. You saw this rapid proliferation of independent blogs, then popular podcasts like Mormon Stories, and these vital, highly sourced websites like Mormon Think, and then it all led up to the viral phenomenon of the CES letter.
And this moment, it just represents the total collapse of the church's century-old information control paradigm. Suddenly, accessing the inconvenient truth was easy, but I think more importantly, it was hidden.
Exactly. Accessing information became much more easy. But the key operational difference was that members could consume this highly critical, well-sourced material secretly.
Right. You didn't have to risk going to the UTLM storefront or checking out a forbidden book from a library.
No, you could listen on your headphones while jogging. You could scroll privately on your phone, read it late at night, completely bypassing the traditional gatekeepers.
Parents, bishops, local leaders.
All of whom were still operating under that 20th century playbook.
Let's talk about the specific content that started to explode online, because it really reveals why those old localized apologetics just failed.
Yeah, a handful of issues became impossible to contain. Take the Book of Abraham translation issues.
Mm-hmm.
Scholars online could just easily compare the papyri fragments we have to the text Joseph Smith produced, and it showed definitively that the translation did not match the Egyptian hieroglyphs.
Or the Kinderhook plates.
Kinderhook plates, which Smith translated and later were admitted to be a forgery. These issues, once contained in these obscure academic papers, were now presented online, clearly, often side by side with church-published images, proving the contradiction.
And of course, the multiple, sometimes conflicting, first vision accounts.
Which demonstrated the narrative evolved over time rather than being a single pristine revelation.
And these were not small issues. This was evidence that directly invalidated the fundamental claims of Smith's prophetic authority.
And the reality of the ancient texts. And this digital shift, it immediately rendered the church's main weapon of communication obsolete.
Completely. Disciplinary action now triggers the exact opposite of its intended effect.
It's the Streisand effect in action.
When the church excommunicated people like Kate Kelly or Sam Young or Bill Reel, it didn't silence them.
No, it amplified their voice. It turned the disciplinary action into a national news story. The action itself emboldened them, and it often grew their following dramatically.
Because the public saw them as martyrs for transparency.
Right. The institution realized that trying to quiet critics now just turned them into public figures. And it led to these major PR nightmares. They learned the hard way that the hammer was now a liability.
And they tried to soften the language, didn't they?
They did. We saw them trying to mitigate the PR damage by changing disciplinary councils to membership reviews or excommunication to withdrawal of membership. They were desperately trying to change the optics of punishment because the old playbook was backfiring violently.
So this crisis comes to a head around 2013, 2014. It's been described that the church was just being handed its lunch by the sheer volume of accessible, contradictory information.
And you pointed out a critical nuance before. The defection wasn't just about historical facts. It was primarily driven by this deep emotional sense of betrayal.
That feeling of betrayal is the heart of the modern crisis.
It is. For 150 years, members have been taught this clean, unambiguous history. The priesthood restoration happened exactly like this. Joseph Smith only had one wife. The Book of Mormon is historically perfect.
And when they discovered, through primary sources, that the church they had dedicated their entire lives, their time, their money to, that it had systematically withheld or obscured or even outright misrepresented facts.
Like Smith's polyandry or the priesthood ban on black members. The reaction was not merely intellectual disagreement. It was a profound emotional rupture. It was the feeling of being gaslit by a trusted parent figure.
And this sense of rupture, it forced the church to make a massive public concession in 2014 with the release of the Gospel Topics essays.
Right, the GTEs. They were the church's official, centralized attempt to respond to the internet's content. And they contained official, albeit very minimized, admissions regarding issues like polygamy.
Including with teenage wives.
Yes. And the use of a seer stone for the Book of Mormon translation and the varying accounts of the first vision.
But they largely failed to stem the tide.
In many cases, they, along with earlier nuanced histories like Richard Bushman's Rough Stone Rolling, they actually caused more doubt.
Yeah.
For the generation raised on that clean narrative, reading the official minimized admissions, it just confirmed their worst fears and validated the need for more rigorous external research.
So the classic apologetics, that firm's approach of focusing on strict, demonstrable historicity, it failed.
The old playbook of suppression failed. Mm-hmm. The church was left without a viable strategy to manage adult disillusionment. They realized they couldn't push the water back into the burst dam.
And that vacuum led directly to abandoning the old approach in favor of what we might call neo-apologetics.
Yeah, and a new institutional strategy. Classic apologetics focused on proving historicity, right? Proving DNA evidence is wrong, or finding Book of Mormon artifacts.
New apologetics.
Championed by figures like Terrell and Fiona Givens and Patrick Mason, it shifts the focus entirely. They emphasize faith, ambiguity, the complexity of prophetic fallibility, and the institutional value of the church despite the historical problems.
But institutionally, the strategy pivoted even harder. It became about proactive inoculation aimed at the youth.
A shift from trying to recover the lost generation of adults to trying to prevent the next generation from ever encountering that information vacuum that caused the betrayal in the first place.
And that shift to a youth focus is the core strategic move of the last, what, 5 or 6 years?
Absolutely. There are reports that Marlon Jensen, the former church historian, admitted that efforts to talk questioning adults back into faith were virtually unsuccessful. So that decision to shift focus almost entirely to preventing the next generation from ever reaching that debilitating knowledge gap is critical.
And they use specific venues for this, youth devotionals, these secretive stake firesides that explicitly excluded parents.
To foster a feeling of intimate trust.
And the seeding of these narratives, this inoculation, into the youth curriculum, like the Saints Book series.
And the tactical goal of inoculation is so straightforward. You give the youth a small, controlled, palatable dose of the inconvenient information. Say, Joseph Smith had multiple accounts of the first vision.
So that when they encounter the full, inconvenient details later, they can just say,
oh, I heard about that complexity. And then they dismiss it as old news. The objective is to foster intellectual complacency, not critical engagement.
And the first major institutionally deployed example of this messaging aimed squarely at the youth was Elder Dale Renlund's 2019 youth face-to-face devotional. It was called Navigating Doubts in Faith.
Yeah, and Renlund, he's a high-ranking member of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, a very powerful voice in the church. And he used these simple, almost cartoonish analogies designed to shame and minimize the experience of the doubter.
Let's analyze his first powerful metaphor, the stay-in-the-boat parable.
Okay, so Renlund frames the church as a rescue boat on a stormy sea, and it's steered by leaders who are the competent fishermen. The person who begins to doubt is portrayed not as a sincere seeker of truth,
no,
but as a spoiled little brat who starts complaining about superficial issues, stale water, worn boots on the leader, and dents and peeling paint on the boat itself.
And then this person throws himself back into the ocean,
which is immediately revealed to be infested with sharks, representing Satan and worldly troubles.
The visual presentation, which was designed to be highly accessible and memorable for a young audience, is so crucial. It manipulates the youth into mocking the doubter and minimizing their concerns.
And the critique is devastating because it equates these profound foundational issues with cosmetic flaws.
It's extremely manipulative. It's targeting teenagers who are highly attuned to fitting in and avoiding peer ridicule.
And the issues Renlund minimizes polygamy, the Book of Mormon's historicity, definitive DNA evidence, the problematic history of the priesthood ban, They are not dents.
They're not peeling paint.
No, they are foundational structural issues. They challenge the very divine claims upon which the organization rests. To call them scrapes in paint is intellectually dishonest.
And that shark analogy reinforces the classic tactic of using fear, uncertainty, and doubt, FUD, to promote learned helplessness.
The message is absolute. The world outside the church is dangerous, toxic, evil. If you leave the boat, you will face the sharks of sin and apostasy. You, as a member, are incapable of navigating moral or intellectual life outside the church's prescribed boundaries.
It paralyzes independent thought by making the spiritual cost of questioning seem lethally high.
And that fear-based minimization leads directly into the second major element of the Renlund talk, which is the shocking straw man of the whack-a-mole game.
This one is maybe the most psychologically damaging analogy.
I think so. They use an actual cartoon illustration of a gopher popping out of a hole with a mallet, featuring issues like the first vision inconsistencies, then polygamy, then the priesthood ban history.
And the doubter is given a name, Stephen.
And Renlund defines Stephen as a perpetual doubter who, and this is a quote, pleased him more to doubt than to know, insinuating that Stephen is actively looking for excuses to leave.
So here the strategy shifts from minimization to assigning outright malicious or childish motives to people who are dealing with these devastating intellectual crises.
It's a complete straw man, and it's utterly manipulative, particularly towards young people who are trying to reconcile their lifelong faith with new facts.
It implies that doubt is a game.
A game played for amusement or intent. But we have to stress that the church, by withholding the history and providing only sanitized narratives, the church was the game designer. The member is the victim who discovers a genuinely defective automobile after committing their entire life and resources to it.
So instead of being sequels of truth who are forced out by contradiction, they are characterized as these frivolous children who derive joy from finding flaws in the system.
The motivation is completely misassigned. Members who leave are not finding joy in problems. They're trying to figure out how to live a more informed, happier, healthier life now that they're fundamental worldview has been destabilized.
Renlund is just inverting the reality of the crisis to emotionally shame the doubter.
And finally, he employs this highly charged inflammatory language to define and demonize doubt itself.
He states, "Doubt, unless converted into inquiry via reliable, trustworthy sources, has no value or worth. Stagnant doubt breeds more doubt and is evil."
That language is so aggressive. He uses words like darkness, poison, blind, ridicule, indolence, lazy, and specifically evil.
This vocabulary is designed to instill deep fear and guilt.
It's a method of short-circuiting critical thought by equating intellectual curiosity with moral failure. And the paradox here is just astonishing.
Because doubt is the essential starting point for science, for healthy spiritual growth.
And even for Joseph Smith's own foundational story, which begins with him doubting all existing churches.
So the ultimate effect is a direct threat to the youth. If you pursue genuine, skeptical inquiry outside our prescribed sources, you are a lazy scholar, and you are dabbling in evil things that will lead to spiritual darkness.
Right. And the goal isn't to discourage doubt for doubt's sake. The goal is to prevent members from achieving truth that might necessitate healthy life decisions about sexuality, career, mental health, marriage, that conflict with the church's demands. It's an active institutional effort to prevent members from pursuing the very ideals of eternal growth and knowledge the organization claims to champion.
Roughly a month after Renlund's emotional youth-targeted messaging, the strategy was reinforced. But this time it was aimed at college students, the people who were supposed to be learning critical thinking at BYU.
Elder Lawrence E. Corbridge. He was introduced as an expert on anti-church materials, and he gave devotional.
And his opening was masterful in its use of rhetorical authority and emotional appeal.
It was. He claimed he had read virtually all anti-church material, assuring the students there was nothing to fear because he had survived the exposure. But the key manipulative element followed. He noted that reading such material always left him with a sense of gloom.
Which, within that specific LDS framework of decision-making, leverages the idea that if a subject makes you feel uncomfortable or bad, the Holy Ghost must be confirming that it isn't true.
Exactly. I felt gloom. Therefore, the content of the history is false or dangerous, and you, the student, don't need to look at it. He establishes his bona fides, defines what is anti-church material, and then claims expertise on how it feels. He's effectively building a mental silo for the students.
But the core of Corbridge's lasting strategic intervention is his framework dividing all questions into two categories, primary and secondary. This is designed to intellectually disarm any critical thinker.
It's a sophisticated shell game. He lists the primary questions, which he argues must be answered first and irrevocably as, is there a God? Is Jesus Christ the Son of God? Was Joseph Smith the prophet? Is the LDS Church the kingdom of God?
Yeah.
And these questions are so cleverly structured. They link generic, widely accepted Christian belief God, Jesus, to the unique contested LDS claims of Joseph Smith and the church.
It makes the entire package harder to reject wholesale without sacrificing their whole Christian identity.
It's a very successful rhetorical move.
Very. Then he lists the secondary questions, which he labels as unending, distracting, and they pale into insignificance if the primary questions are answered positively. And this is where he tucks away all the inconvenient historical facts.
All of them. Church history details, polygamy, the history of blacks and women in the priesthood, Book of Mormon translation and DNA issues, different accounts of the first vision, the church's stance on gay marriage.
Let's pause here because the critique of this framework is that it's a total bait and switch.
Right. Couldn't one argue, though, that Corbridge has a point? That complex, often messy historical details are secondary to the simple spiritual witness one receives, and he's just protecting his students from getting lost in the weeds.
And that is precisely the argument. The new strategy hinges on prioritizing spiritual feeling over factual history. But the fundamental flaw is that the secondary questions are, in reality, the only functional way to answer the primary questions in a verifiable manner.
Okay, elaborate on that connection.
Well, how can you definitively answer, was Joseph Smith a prophet, without examining the historical record? If the historical record shows that the multiple accounts of the first vision contain significant contradictory details about who appeared and why, that directly affects the claim of prophethood.
And if the DNA evidence in the Book of Mormon shows the Native Americans did not descend from Jerusalem,
which contradicts the Book of Mormon's core narrative, that invalidates the primary claim that Joseph Smith translated an ancient, authentic historical record. You simply can't answer the primary question without scrutinizing the secondary evidence.
It's like that analogy we discussed before. You're buying a house, which is the primary question, is this a safe place to live? And the realtor, Corbridge, is saying, the house has a door and a roof, so it's great. Those are the basic primary elements.
Right. But the secondary questions are the foundation, the plumbing, and the wiring. If the foundation has massive cracks, the house is unsafe. If the plumbing is backing up and the wiring is faulty, you have structural integrity issues.
And the realtor telling you to ignore those issues because the house has a door and a roof is being fundamentally dishonest about the product's safety and integrity.
Corbridge is attempting to intellectually decouple the claimed prophet from the evidence, the history.
And he compounds this intellectual misdirection by deploying a straw man argument about the motivation of doubters.
Yeah, he argues that doubters mistakenly try to learn the truth by process of elimination and cannot prove the church is true by disproving every claim made against it.
Which is an extremely common yet dishonest apologetic maneuver. It's designed to make the member feel overwhelmed.
Because you don't need to eliminate every single doubt, do you? You just need one or two fatal contradictions.
Absolutely not. That's the straw man. If I claim I can fly by flapping my arms, you don't need to test every single muscle and joint to prove I'm wrong. You just test the fundamental claim.
Exactly. In the church's case, one piece of definitive disconfirming evidence, like the genetic science showing Native Americans came from Asia, not the ancient Near East, which destroys the Book of Mormon's historical basis, is sufficient to invalidate the primary claim that Joseph Smith was a prophet who translated an authentic record.
Doubters aren't trying to eliminate every flaw.
No, they're simply identifying fatal contradictions in the foundational claims. Corbridge's goal is to successfully convince college students that all the difficult historical issues are merely secondary weeds, so they will voluntarily choose to avoid the critical research that could ultimately lead them out of the church.
Which brings us to the culmination of this messaging strategy. The directive issued by the highest leadership, showing that this is not just motivational speaking, but organizational policy.
Just 1 month after Corbridge delivered his framework, Dallin H. Oaks, who was the president of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles and the expected next prophet, he dropped what is arguably the most controversial quote in modern doubt management.
And the context here is so critical. He wasn't speaking to youth or students. He was asked specifically how a believing member should handle a non-believing spouse who left the faith due to research. This is a question about relationship survival versus institutional loyalty.
And this is the ultimate red flag for observers of organizational behavior. Oakes asserted, and I'm quoting the directive he gave to the believing spouse here, "I suggest that research is not the answer. But the best answer to any question that threatens faith is to work to increase faith in the Lord Jesus Christ."
Research is not the answer. That is just an astonishing statement from the leader of an organization that claims to possess the single restored source of truth and knowledge in the modern era.
And the analysis of his intent reveals the strategic priority. Oakes is explicitly telling the believing spouse to not engage in honest research or even constructive conversation with their doubting partner.
Instead, the faithful spouse has to retreat into the church's prescribed defensive mechanisms, prayer, study, service, focusing on spiritual feelings, as a means of self-protection against facts.
And the implication for marital relationships is devastating. This privileges the organization's integrity over the marriage bond. It's instructing one spouse to build a brick wall of willful, faith-based ignorance between themselves and their partner.
It isolates the doubting spouse and makes essential, honest communication about life, about values, about your shared reality impossible.
And this directive, it stands as this profound paradox within the context of the faith itself. The foundational LDS hymn, "O Say, What Is Truth?" extols truth as the fairest gem for the searcher's mind.
And Oakes's instruction to avoid research is completely antithetical to that historical ideal of relentlessly seeking knowledge and truth. The Mormonism many grew up with preached the ideal, do what is right, let the consequence follow.
This strategy is fundamentally about avoiding consequence by actively avoiding truth.
To many outside the faith, and increasingly many inside, this statement is the clearest, most explicit admission that the church knows its central historical and truth claims do not hold up to scrutiny when they're examined honestly.
Absolutely. No one would trust any secular institution, a politician, a car manufacturer, a financial advisor, a pharmaceutical company that demands your lifelong loyalty, 10% of your income, and full obedience, but explicitly prohibits you from researching its safety, its efficacy, or its integrity.
If the church had satisfactory answers to the complexities of polygamy or the Book of Abraham or DNA evidence, they would encourage members to research and send the doubter their way, confident in the outcome.
Instead, they tell the faithful to run from the information, and that is institutional cowardice disguised as piety.
And this fear of inquiry, framed as protection, was immediately echoed by others. Just a few months later, Elder Kimby Christensen, also in a high-ranking position, reinforced this anti-research stance in another youth devotional.
Christensen told the youth, "Doubts about things we already know are very dangerous." And his strategy for counseling a doubter is to find a restore point, like a computer system reset to a previous uncorrupted version of the operating system.
So he tries to take the member back to the powerful emotional feelings they had on their mission, or when first reading the Book of Mormon,
before they encounter the inconvenient historical facts.
So the prescribed solution to a crisis that is fundamentally fact-based is to actively ignore the facts and prioritize an emotional memory.
It's highly manipulative. It's telling members to stop intellectual and spiritual progression and improvement, which, again, ironically, is against the core Mormon ideal of eternal growth and knowledge. The message is simple. Feelings are more reliable than facts.
And as we've established throughout this deep dive, the only entity that doubts are dangerous to is the organization that benefits from the members' uninformed loyalty and continued financial compliance. The new strategy sacrifices truth in favor of obedience.
So if we synthesize these two organizational eras, the contrast is stark. But the goal, it remains the same. Organizational survival.
The historical strategy of suppression.
Using excommunication, demonization, and physical control over information through cases like Brody, the Tanners, the September 6th, that was successful only until the internet removed the geographic and print barriers.
And the modern strategy of inoculation spearheaded by leaders like Renland, Corbridge, and Oakes is a sophisticated psychological effort. It's an attempt to control the meaning of the information and the motive of the inquirer rather than trying to control the information itself.
They minimize foundational flaws as cosmetic dents. They recategorize critical history as secondary or unimportant distractions, and they explicitly instruct members to reject intellectual research in favor of emotional feelings and unquestioning authority.
The entire modern strategic playbook is built on the fear that if you examine the foundational claims, you will inevitably leave. It is a defense strategy designed to foster intellectual paralysis and learned helplessness.
And the overall message that emerges for you, the listener, is paramount, regardless of your background. When leaders of any organization, especially one that demands lifelong commitment, significant time, and substantial financial resources, when they tell their members that Research is not the answer.
It is the strongest possible indicator that the claims being sold cannot withstand critical objective examination. It is an explicit demand for an emotional commitment independent of the facts.
It forces the believer into a choice between intellectual honesty and institutional loyalty.
Which brings us to our final provocative thought. If you encounter information that contradicts a deeply held belief, whether that belief is religious, political, or personal, which choice is more reflective of maturity, intelligence, and moral courage? Is it adopting the mentality of the lazy scholar by rejecting the facts and returning to a comfortable emotional memory, that so-called restore point? Or is it embracing the relentless pursuit of truth above all else, letting the consequences follow wherever they may lead, even if it requires building a whole new foundation? That, ultimately, is the difficult yet essential choice the modern church and every institution facing the information challenge is trying to prevent you from making.